Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd. Happy July, everyone. And I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. The only reason that I can keep that going is because of support from listeners just like you. The big supporters this week are Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, The Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you would like to hear your name at the top of the show, or you just want to show your support for Talk Nerdy, go head on over to patreon.com/talknerdy and click around, see what's the haps. All right, guys, I have a really exciting show for you this week because I have a chance to talk to somebody who is really affecting change nationwide. Her name is Bertha Vasquez. She is a middle school science teacher in Miami-Dade County Public Schools. She is also the director of the Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, which is a division of the Center for Inquiry. And we are going to be talking today about the incredible work that the Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science, aka TIES, is doing to provide middle school teachers the tools that they need to teach evolution and answer its critics based on new next generation science standards. So without any further ado, here she is, Bertha Vasquez. Well, Bertha, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So I'm really excited. You know, I've been, I feel like kind of close to the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science for a really long time. I know it's part of the Center for Inquiry or Inquiry, however you want to pronounce that. Yeah. Is, I think, okay with me. Always been really great in supporting my work, and I've kind of worked together with some of the different groups on different aspects. But you are particularly heavily involved with TIES, which stands for the Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science. First of all, what is TIES? And second of all, what do you do with TIES?
Okay, well, TIES is an institute that is run entirely by teachers.
Oh, cool.
And yes, and that I think that's a very important thing in this day and age, promoting teacher leadership. And what's going on is, thankfully, more and more, you're starting to see evolution standards, evolutionary biology standards at the middle school level. Mm-hmm. And what happens is middle school teachers work. I'm a middle school teacher. I've been teaching middle school for 27 years now. Today was my last day of school, by the way.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, it's a great feeling every year. The good feeling never goes away.
But good timing.
Yes. So I have to teach everything from weather, you know, meteorology to earth science to life science. And the following year, you might get a different grade level and you might get a different curriculum. So it's really hard to be an expert in all of these areas. For example, I'm terrible with geology. And I was very lucky to team teach for a couple of years with a teacher who just loved rocks. And I learned so much from her. And when I was alone after that teaching geology, we weren't team teaching anymore. I was just a much better teacher because I understood my subject matter. I taught it with confidence. And you actually transfer passion that way when you really like and enjoy a subject and know your subject. So I thought evolution's a tough subject to teach. And if you don't understand it, which is, it's perfectly okay. As Richard Dawkins says, we're all ignorant about something. There's no shame in that. You're less likely to teach it because evolution is a subject where there may be parents who bring up their concerns or kids who are anxious in your classroom. So if we as an institute, the TIES Institute, if we can give teachers confidence, but not just confidence, but content. And not just content, but classroom resources, and everything is free. I think teachers are going to be more excited to teach the subject. And it's just such a great, interesting subject that that's what we do. So we started in 2015. And since then, yesterday was our 92nd workshop. So in 3 years, what started with me, one teacher in Miami, Florida, we now are about 50 teachers strong. And we've presented in 36 states. Yesterday, we had a presentation in Georgia. Last Saturday was our first presentation in Oklahoma. And so what I do is I recruit mainly high school AP biology teachers, mm-hmm. and I show them the resources that we have. I train them in the presentation, and then they go and present to middle school science teachers. Like I said, basically content, but also resources. And then we have a web page where teachers can go and download, for example, an entire unit from the icebreaker to the exam. They could download a classroom presentation with tons of active learning ideas in the notes section. We have videos. We have resources shared by our fellow teachers. We also have monthly webinars where I invite guest speakers to come, for example, evolutionary biologists, science authors. Richard Dawkins did one for us. And then anybody could join those. Those are free as well. And this is all funded by the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science.
I've got to ask, I'm looking at your website and there's so many excellent materials. And like you said, you guys are getting out there 34 out of the 50 states. Is that right?
We're at 36.
Look at that. Since the last time I got an email,
exactly.
It's gone up by two. That's amazing. Obviously, I think you and I share very similar secular values. I think that's part of why I thought it was so important to have you on the show. And you and I, you know, care about education. You've dedicated your life to education at the secondary school level. Do you have concerns at all, or have you found that it helps or it hurts to be a division of the, you know, he's got a famous name, like it or not, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science?
It's helped and hurt. I walk a fine line.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, a lot of my presenters joined us because they're admirers of Richard Dawkins.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just think he's a fabulous biologist. And I actually have some of his videos about DNA and evolution embedded in our presentations. So most people, it's not a big deal. I'd say 95% of the time, whether you're secular or religious, if you're interested in teaching high quality evolution in your classroom, it doesn't matter to them. There have been a few instances where I have people say, sorry, we can't have anything to do with the Richard Dawkins Foundation. We admire what you're doing, or we like what you're doing, but no. So that's happened a few times to me.
And do you find that that has more to do with when you're trying to reach maybe areas that are more religious, maybe that have more creationist influence, southern states, things like that?
Yes. And I think, you know, by nature, teachers are risk averse. And that's why evolution can be a very tricky subject in the classroom, because you just don't really want to deal with parents and kids and you feel bad and you don't know what to say. Yes, the times that I've had trouble, it's been in places where you'd expect, like the South. So you're right about, your assumptions are correct.
And so I grew up in the South. I was born and raised in Texas, and I lived there, you know, almost my whole life until I moved to New York for a year. And now I've been in LA for about 8 or 9 years. Are you in Florida? Did I get that right?
I'm in South Florida.
You're in South Florida. So I there are a lot of parallels that we could draw between Texas and Florida. I think they're two places that have a very strong sense of an independent state, kind of states' rights nature. And they're also places where there are a lot of very entrenched creationists.
Yes.
What has that experience been like for you, not just as kind of an activist and somebody who's trying to, you know, get the message out and help other teachers teach evolution, but also just as a teacher?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm in South Florida, and we joke around here that you have to go north to go south.
Oh, yeah. Because like Pensacola, places like that, they tend to be a little
world.
More entrenched. Yeah.
Oh, it's a completely different world. And I've done workshops in Orlando, Tallahassee, Port St. Lucie. And you really do go north to go south. Here in South Florida, we have more of a, well, it's very international. But it's also more like you run into a lot of Northerners. There's a lot of people here from New England and New York, Pennsylvania. What I'm trying to do with this institute is put a positive twist on evolution education. I don't want to say, oh, let's just face the creationist head on. What I try to do is, this is the content. This is what you're supposed to be teaching in your classroom. It's not up to you. It's up to the state standards. That way the teacher doesn't feel the pressure when a parent comes in to complain. The teacher can get out of the argument. One of the things we really do on the webpage is we have the National Science Teachers Association's position on evolution education. We have the NSF, National Science Foundation, position on evolution education. So the teacher can say, it's not up to me. Because at this point, a lot of states have really, really good standards, including a lot of southern states or places you think teachers might have more trouble. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. Here are your standards. Let's teach them really well. Second thing, this is cool stuff. This is awesome, interesting way to see the world. And so I try to promote that positive end. Now, in terms of the creationists and stuff, we do have on the website a link to addressing misconceptions, because I think that's the big problem, is that there's a lot of misconceptions. If I had a dollar for every time a kid told me that evolution was just a theory,
yeah,
I wouldn't need to teach anymore. So we do have ways for teachers to address those children that are feeling anxious or a little bit, you know, resentful in the classroom that they have to learn what they're learning.
You know, you mentioned that it's really comes down to the state and the standards of the state. And, forgive my ignorance, but I really don't even know how curriculum standards work anymore. Is there a minimum federal standard? I know that there's like a new core curriculum. What's it called? That like is required?
NGSS, Next Generation Science Standards.
Okay, sure. I was also thinking of like, for math, there's the whatever. Oh gosh, I'm so terrible at
this. There's Common Core.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking of. Common Core. And is Common Core a federal initiative?
Yeah, but it's the state standard. The in terms of evolution, it's state standards. There's
always
no federal anything on top of that. So a bunch of states, I believe there's about, I might be giving you the wrong number, but there's about 16 states that have adopted what are called the Next Generation Science Standards.
Okay.
Now, while some people have some issues with aspects of the, they're called NGSS, they're really good. They have really good evolution standards at the middle school level. Some states that have not adopted NGSS have excellent middle school science standards. Florida, believe it or not, being one of them.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, we also have the law that anybody in the state can challenge what is being done in a classroom. You don't even have to have a child in the public school system. So, you know, we have both things going on here. But, and then there are states that are not Next Generation Science Standard states that have really just abysmal evolution standards, even at the high school level.
I have to guess, is Tennessee one of them? Because they have a long track record. I mean,
I don't know. I don't think so. I could look it up. I did a whole study on that where I got a bunch of teachers and we went through every middle school science standard on evolution document across the country, and we graded all of the states. And I could look up Tennessee while we're sitting here, but I know, for example, Arizona was pretty low, Texas, Alaska. Yeah.
Oh, man. So. Yeah. I honestly don't know if I remember learning evolution in school. Isn't that crazy? I probably did. I actually had an incredible eighth grade biology teacher who I think went above and beyond with the required curriculum. Her name was Mrs. Silva. She was amazing. And
see,
I loved her.
We all remember one of our teachers.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Especially the ones that really affect us. But outside of her classroom, as I continued on, I'm not sure I remember talking about evolution much until I got to the college level.
And that's, you know, I have a very good friend. Her name's Michelle. And she's the one that she said to me, you know, I don't remember learning this. And it makes me really angry. This stuff is really cool. And not only that, you know, it's not just cool. It brings everything together. It's the underlying theme of the life sciences. Everything makes sense in light of evolution, right? The famous quote. And so I kind of try to take that attitude when I work with TIES. And when you ask me what I do for TIES, I'm the director of TIES. And it's kind of
your program.
I am TIES. I have two people, wonderful, wonderful teachers, both classroom teachers full time that help me. And I have the presenters that are all full time, you know, classroom teachers that present for me in different parts of the country. But I'm the one who kind of coordinates everything. And I thought this isn't fair. We're keeping kids from learning something that makes the world make sense.
Yeah.
And when I hear an adult say that, oh, I wish someone had taught me evolution in school, why didn't they? that's what I'm trying to do, is just make it more commonplace, make it more fun, use a lot of hands-on and fun activities so that the teachers go back to their classrooms looking forward to teaching this.
Do you find that when you speak to adults, even adults who are, 100% accepting of evolution, who agree with a science-based worldview, who, whether they're religious or not, think that it's important to learn about evolution because it is the kind of process by which speciation occurs, all that good stuff. But then when you actually start to talk to them, they have fundamentally flawed views about what evolution does. They think it's guided. They think it's working towards something. Like, there are all these, and it, really that must just come down to, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of social pressure. There's a lot of misinformation out there just that you get passively. But also, if you're not learning it when you're in like sponge form, right?
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the thing. Evolution shouldn't be taught as a discrete unit in the month of April, or whenever it is you bring it up. It should be somewhat, it's like a thread that ties everything together. And I, for example, I taught sixth grade for 25 years. And my favorite lab activity is called the owl pellet lab. Have you ever heard of this?
I have one in my closet.
Okay. I love this. I'm such a nerd. Okay. That's the name of your show. So we're good. So I did this for 25 years where I teach the kids the human skeleton because we're studying human biology. And then I give them an owl pellet. And basically, for those of you out there who don't know what we're talking about, when the owl eats a mouse, the part that cannot be digested gets regurgitated and it looks like a little ball of fur, and embedded in the fur is a bunch of little bones. So the kids, fun. Oh, it's the best thing ever. So the kids dissect this, right? And they pull out the humerus and the femur and the ulna and the radius and the rib and the skull. I did this for 25 years, Kara. It didn't occur to me, and I'm so ashamed to say this, but it didn't occur to me to say, hey, kids, I didn't teach you the skeleton of the rat or the shrew. I taught you a human skeleton. How is it that you can take this bone that's 1 centimeter long and tell me that it's a radius? I never made that connection. And that's what I'm saying. Evolution should be taught like that. It should be taught like a thread going across the whole curriculum. And that's kind of what we're promoting. And we're promoting the idea. Another story. I went to Shenandoah National Park with my 13-year-old son last October, and we got a ranger talk. And the ranger was talking about the erosion of the mountains. And, you know, those are very old mountains. He kept talking about the processes that formed these mountains. And it was super interesting, but he never said an age. He never dated the mountains. So when he was kind of by himself over to the side, I walked over there and I said, hey, how come you're not giving us the age of these mountains? And he gave me this very scary, like, here's one of these ladies. I said, I know they're 300 to 500 million years old. He goes, oh, thank goodness. I go, but what's the deal? He goes, well, I worked in Utah for a really long time. And I lost a lot of people when I started talking about the age of the earth. So now I just focus on the processes. You know, my reaction was anger. My reaction was, here is my 13-year-old kid who can learn this awesome scale of time. It's so mind-blowing. It's so beautiful to think about and wrap your head around. And he is being denied basic science, cool, awesome science, because there's people that might be offended by this, the fact of science. Ugh. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's like you almost can't be mad at the ranger. You have to be mad at all of the people who shaped the behavior over so many years that he was finding himself in a position where he was like, well, if I'm going to reach people, I have to alter my approach.
Exactly. Exactly. But then we lose out. Our kids lose out. And my friend who was, or you, that you were never taught this awesome study as a young person, you lose out. Yeah. And I think over across the country right now, ties isn't just the only, I don't want to call it a movement, but we're not the only group of teachers that are pushing for higher quality evolution education. Mm-hmm. I think there's a pushback going on. And actually, Scientific American interviewed me, and they went to see a Thais teacher present evolution to her class in Georgia. Mm-hmm. And we'll be featured in the August. I've been told it's slated to run in the August issue of Scientific American. Yeah. And that's the other reason I love that Thais is teacher run, because a lot of people understand education and they're wonderful professors and so forth, but I think you got to be in the classroom to kind of really understand what's going on.
Oh, for sure. You have to know how the students are going to receive the information, and you have firsthand knowledge because you're with them every day.
Mm-hmm. And this is the first year that no one questioned me. No one took an F on the exam because they didn't want to do anything on evolution. This is the first year that I didn't have any trouble. And I'm really? In a major urban area, mainly, you know, foreigners. So I get very little pushback from
And you
from my
still
school.
Have historically always had at least one student.
At least three or four, yes. This is the first time.
You know, I have to tell you, before I left academia, I was teaching intro biology, like bio 101 to college students, uh-huh. both in Texas and New York. And, you know, I always equate freshman college students to high school seniors. They seem to be like somewhere around the same level, if not even a little bit before. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm in Texas, in North Texas, I'm in the Bible Belt, and I teach evolution. And like, sometimes I get pushback and sometimes I don't, but there's always kind of a conversation around it. And then when I finally moved to New York, I'm thinking, oh, yes, finally I'm going to be in an area, I'm in the city where I'm not going to have to deal with that anymore. So I'm in Queens, I'm at Queens College, you know, which is a borough in actual New York City. And because the population there just happens to be a heavily Orthodox Jewish population, mm-hmm. I find myself facing the same things. I have these students who are like, Professor, you don't really believe in evolution, do you? And I'm like, oh, wow, here comes a real conversation. It's just so interesting that even in places you don't expect, like I think we tend to stereotype, but this kind of pushback exists all over the country.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, some of my California presenters have brought it up. I was heckled once. Like I said, there's been 92 presentations. And especially the first year, a lot of those were mine. And I traveled a lot more than I'm traveling now. Thankfully, I'm not traveling so much. It was in Ohio, where one of the teachers gave me a hard time in the room.
Ohio.
Yeah. So, and then there was one other one up north somewhere too, that someone told me she was offended by one of the videos and stuff. No, it's not a South thing. It's just like you said, they ask you, well, Professor, you don't actually believe in evolution. That just mm-hmm. the word alone, there's a problem with that.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Neil deGrasse Tyson says it, science is true whether you believe in it or not. And I don't know. It's hard every year after year. Richard Dawkins has a book called The Greatest Show on Earth. And he likens it to a professor of Roman history that every year has to defend the existence of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. And every year people come back with the same tired things. You know, what about the eye? The eye's too complex. Or what about the second law of thermodynamics or something? And every year the same tired arguments. You have to explain why they're wrong over and over again.
Well, and it doesn't help that when you like Google, is evolution true, or the words evolution, there are these basically lobbying groups. I mean, I don't know what else to call them, that are anti-evolutionists, that are creationists. And really, it comes down for them. I think the ones that are pulling the strings and actually do have agenda-driven influence, it comes down to raising funds for creationist religious, you know, empire, basically. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but, you know, there are a lot of people who struggle with evolution because they don't understand it, who aren't necessarily religious per se, but definitely the powers that be, quote unquote, the actual movement that's trying to take evolution education out of schools is agenda driven. It's not a passive thing that's happening.
No, you're right. You're right. And I like to take the position of like, it is not fair. They are denying our children a quality mm-hmm. science education. I wrote a letter to Arizona when they were just last week, they were reviewing the new standards, and boy, they needed new standards, I'll tell you. And I believe the teachers worked on those standards for over a year. Am I correct? And then at the last minute, they took the word evolution out. They took Big Bang out. Of course, same old stuff, the climate change. And so there was a period of public comment where you could go in and tell them what you thought of the way they change the standards at the last minute. And that was my position. My position is, why are you denying children a quality education?
Yeah. Why do you want them to be behind? Why do you want them to not be competitive?
Standing up and saying, I want my child when in Shenandoah National Park to learn about evolution education or the age of the earth or whatever. And we need to understand this. That's the other thing in ties we push a lot is current evolution. Not, yes, we need to talk about Darwin and the beagle and the finches, but we need to talk about agriculture and how evolutionary biology informs agriculture, conservation efforts across the world, medicine, you know, make it relevant. I'll tell you, in Georgia, the teacher who was interviewed by Scientific American, the teacher who was brave enough, she's wonderful, to have the Scientific American reporter come into her classroom. She was kind of nervous. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll tell you how I start. I do genetics first, and then I take a box of my dog's flea medication and I put it on my desk and I tell a true story. I bought this box. It was $70 and I use it on my dog and it doesn't work. So I take my dog to the vet and the vet says, oh yeah, that doesn't work anymore. That stuff doesn't work anymore. $70 pet supermarket. So I ask my kids, I sit back and I go, okay, write down, tell me why this doesn't work anymore. Just your with your understanding of genetics, why doesn't this medication work anymore? Of course.
Yeah, knowing that it used to.
Yeah, knowing that it used to. So they come up pretty easily. It's not like you were saying that evolution, there's a lot of misconceptions and a lot of things that are hard to understand, but the basic premise is actually quite simple. And it's okay, well, there was a mutation and a mutation made them resistant to the flea medication. Those fleas survived. Those fleas passed that trait on to the next generation. And the fleas that weren't resistant, they died.
Yeah, so they didn't have any fitness. Yeah.
So I put my feet up on my desk. I cross my legs and I go, okay, we're done with evolution. We're moving on to... We're moving on to ecology now. Really? We're
done? You got it.
And you got it. That's it. That's what all the fuss is about, right? Like, I know there's more to the fuss. There's the whole speciation and micro versus macroevolution and everything, but that's really it. And that's how she started her lesson in Georgia. And it was a true story for her too, except it wasn't on her dog. It was in her carpets in her home. But this, the same idea. And that's kind of where we need to go, I think, too. Some teachers don't even start with Darwin because that's just such a trigger word for so many people.
Yeah.
You just start with genetics and mutation and you can't have much argument there.
Yeah. Talk about your antibiotics. Talk about, you know, something that's relevant to you. Like you went to the doctor and they were like, we can't give you penicillin because it won't work on this. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, this, oh, we have to test, we have to culture this, you know, what looks like a spider bite to see what antibiotics work on it because it's actually MRSA. Like those kinds of things are relevant to everybody every day. And that's the part for me that always blows my mind, that people can like just look at all of the evidence surrounding them and still deny it. But maybe it's just because they don't fully understand the evidence.
Yes, or they do draw the distinction between micro versus macroevolution. I never heard those words until I started working with ties.
Yeah, that's what my father did. You know, I told you I grew up in Texas, and it's funny that you mentioned Utah because I also grew up in a Mormon family in Texas. So I had, you know, some less family in Utah, but like definitely my sisters went to college there. You know, we had ties to Utah. And, you know, it's interesting because Mormons, I don't want to paint them with a broad brush because I'm not sure if everybody is taught the exact same thing. But my dad had this very, like, he's super pro-science, really always promoted me going into science. He's an engineer, but he drew lines in the sand that were like, yeah, you know, he believed in evolution, quote unquote. He would say things like, yeah, evolution exists. Yeah, I totally get that things mutate, and I totally, oh, but speciation is not a result of evolution. Like he would like accept it up to a point until it threatened the worldview that he learned that was a more fundamentalist religious worldview. Yeah. So it's like he was trying to find a balance between the two things. And it always really struggled after I, you know, left the religion and after I learned about science to be like, okay, where's the justification? Why are they going about it? It's like he's really trying, but like still within this weird structure that he can't seem to shake. And that must be so hard when you're working with these kids who are coming with all these preconceived notions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And different religions, so different preconceived notions.
And different levels of sophistication, right? Like,
absolutely.
I think some of the older people have devised a whole justification, but younger people are just like, no, it's wrong.
And teachers are always in a much more difficult position, because if you're sitting at a coffee shop or talking to your father, you can be a little more abrupt, or you can you can say things like, well, you know what, that's just plain wrong. But you can't really do that in a classroom, because it's a child, and you don't want to make them feel bad, or make them feel bad about their parents. Are their parents liars? I mean, you don't want them to think bad things about their parents.
So, yeah, you don't want to shatter their sense of security in the world either.
So you have to go about it in a very gentle, loving way, you know.
And you guys have to walk a legal line too. Like, you know, my mother, she was a teacher for, I don't even know, 25, 30 years, maybe 30 years before she just recently retired. She was also a middle school teacher. She taught Spanish. And I used to tell her all the time, just like I would say to you and say to anybody listening who's a teacher, that you guys are damn heroes, and you have like such patience. I taught college level kids, and they were little shits, and I could be like, you're being a shit, get out of my classroom.
Oh,
but you can't do that in middle school.
No,
your job is to motivate them to want to be there.
Yes.
Like, I could literally be like, you're paying me to teach you this class right now. You don't want to be here. That's your problem, you know?
Yeah.
But you can't do that.
So I can bash their faith, or I can make them go, wow, this is really cool. I want to learn more about this.
Yeah.
So I go with option B. Oh, I always go with option B. Plus, I think option A, actually talking about faith and stuff like that, you are pushing up against the establishment clause of the Constitution, which, so I try to avoid the religion conversation altogether. And I think most teachers do.
Yeah, like, there's a place for that as an activist if you're trying to, you know, work within the legal system, or you're trying to, if you need to raise suit or be involved in a class action to try and see basically unconstitutional legislation changed. But that's not, the place for that is not in the classroom with the students.
No, and most teachers will, we tend to talk, you know, at the beginning of the workshop, people tell us where they're from and why they're here, and a little history. And a lot of people will basically say, I say, look, guys, I'm not going to talk to you about religion. I'm not going to talk to you about faith. I'm talking to you about science. This is how you understand how we get our answers in science, through inquiry, through questions, through data collection, through, you know, peer review, et cetera. And I am just teaching you the science. And if you want to discuss theology, go home to your parents, go home to your faith leader. And I'd say that 90% or more of the teachers that I've encountered working for TIES, that is their position in the classroom. And I think that's a good position, because you can't really talk about religion in the classroom.
Yeah. So. And it's a respectful position too, because like you said, you know, instead of bashing what somebody is holding dear in an effort to educate them, all that's going to do is push them away.
Exactly, I mean, exactly.
So science communicators do it a lot, and it bums me out. Like, it's just, you're going to catch more flies with honey. You know,
yes.
It's just going to be more exciting to people if they can't help but be thrilled about it, because it's just fascinating.
I think we have if you want to think like in a commercial sense, we have a better product to sell. We have a more exciting product. It is amazing. I showed my kids Eat Your Inner Fish by Neil Shubin.
Good. I had him on the show.
Oh, gosh. Well, many years ago, I wrote questions for his book, Your Inner Fish. He put them on his website. I sent him a picture of my students holding the skull of an alligator, because it's the closest thing to Tiktaalik I could find, right?
That's awesome.
So he sends my class a cast of the head of Tiktaalik. It was still wet and cold, you know, when it came in, and all the kids all around me, and we're opening this box, and that right there, I'm telling you, it's a better product. We don't have to work so hard to sell this, because it is just cool. The whole idea of your inner fish, and you know the song Evo Devo, to the there's a song Despacito, right?
Yep.
So the Evo Devo version, in my humble opinion, is way better than the real version.
And that song is so catchy, it so gets stuck in your head.
I can't get it out of my head. Here's how we go from single cells to people. Anyway, this is cool stuff. All we got to do is expose kids to it, expose it to them with a little passion and hand movement as we speak. Show them, some hands. I know it's not that simple. I know I'm simplifying it, but evolution acceptance among young people is higher. As you know, people under 30, I believe it's at 60%+ now, as opposed to people, across all age groups. It is increasing. And I want to believe that, that probably has something to do with the loss of religiosity across the country. But I also think it has to do with great science textbooks, science communicators, Bill Nye, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I think shows on TV, Cosmos, I think kids are getting into science because, like I said, it's fun. It's cool.
Ready to become a leader? Enroll in Army ROTC. You could get a full tuition scholarship and you'll graduate a leader and an officer in the U.S. Army. Army officers inspire strength in others. To receive more information about the Army ROTC program, visit goarmy.com/podcast today. Paid for by the United States Army. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. And also, I mean, we can't help but see that there is a correlation too between, like you just said, a lack of religiosity. It's not so much that people aren't religious anymore. I just think that the fundamentalist movement, it doesn't work for modern young people. Like, they just don't want to think in those really harsh and I think oppressive terms, because even young conservatives tend to be more socially progressive, and they might still be fiscally conservative, but just across the board, young people are more accepting of people from different races and religions and sexual orientations and gender identities. It's just the way the world is now.
Yeah. And that's
great.
And that includes more accepting of science and science fact.
Absolutely. So absolutely.
I mean, I'm positive. I really am. I feel very positive, and I see the need for ties. I see how it's just, this has grown like wildfire. I mean, like I said, one teacher in Miami in 2015, and we're at 92 workshops as of this week. And that just shows there's a need for it. People are interested in learning about this. Teachers are interested in learning how to teach it better and picking up good resources. And things happen really fast these days. You know, statistics seem to be changing within 10 years. You see the percentages changing. So I don't know. If we have this conversation 10 years from now, I think we'll look back and see very positive trends.
Oh, absolutely.
Despite the current pushback.
That's kind of the question that I was going to say. I mean, this is not a new issue. The Scopes trial was a long time ago. And, you know, we've been vacillating back and forth about kind of how does the First Amendment fit in? What kinds of protections are available under the law? Like, this has been a really intense debate and conversation for quite some time. But you said that the first workshop that you guys did was in 2015.
Yes.
Okay. So obviously, the new presidential administration was elected into office on November 8th, 2016. Yeah. He, became the president. He was inaugurated on January 20th, 2017. This happened as you've been working in ties. Have you seen a big change? How has it affected things? Or is it
Nothing.
Just kind of business as usual?
It's funny. 2 weeks ago, a New York Times reporter asked me this question. There might be some, like what's going on in Arizona, I think they're more emboldened by the president's positions. But no, as a matter of fact, last year was a banner year for ties. We got 44 workshops last year. I mean, we just blew it out of the water. So no, I don't feel any change from 2015 till today. It's just growing.
That's awesome.
It's just growing. It's kind of like alternative energy investment. No matter what he says, no matter what he's talking about, clean coal or whatever, the alternative energy investment is increasing, and solar energy and all these costs are going down. And you cannot stop the wave. No, I'm saying we just have to hang through this dark period of anti-science, and hopefully, I don't know. I have to be optimistic. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you know what? I feel the same way. And I've said it before on the show. I think that the reason that this election and this administration felt so severe was because of the progress we had made.
Yeah.
It felt like a stumble. It felt like a step backward simply because we had moved so far forward. And that's just how progress happens. Sometimes it's, you know, three steps forward, two steps back. But eventually, you know, the arrow of time is bending towards progress. Mm-hmm. Like we just, and that keeps me, optimistic when there are days when I definitely feel cynical. When I open, you know, my iPhone first thing in the morning and I see all of the news popping up and I'm like, oh yeah. God, what happened today? That's when I start to feel a little more optimistic, is remembering those things. But so Ties, I mean, even in the name, Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science, are you finding more and more that there are other aspects of kind of science education that are requiring the same kind of effort, like climate change, oh, yeah. you mentioned, and some of the other areas where science has become politicized. And so even though there's consensus, or GMOs, for example, but that kind of falls within the evolution side. But even though there's consensus within the scientific community, you still get kind of politicized pushback.
Yeah. And I think a lot of teachers, they're just trying to get day to day, get by day to day and get their kid to soccer practice on time and get their grades in at the end of the 9 weeks. They're really busy. We're doing more and yeah. more with less and less. And that's why we need things like Ties, because we can do the groundwork for them. We could say, here's your whole unit. And it's been piloted in many classrooms. It's been reviewed by teachers and NGSS developers and biologists. Here it is, an entire package. Use it and take it. It's high quality. And I think that's one of the reasons Ties is so successful. Now, climate change, yeah, that's another one.
Ugh, I know. And it's like, you can't do everything, right?
I did a lot of that. That actually,
that's awesome. Kinda, you're like, I do.
That was my first real passion as a teacher, was environmental education. And even, I mean, 1 year I pushed this thing at my school, and in one calendar year, we saved $52,000 in electrical costs.
Oh, cool. Just at your school?
Just at my one school.
Neat.
1 year, we did a bunch of environmental testing and environmental sampling around the school, and we won a $150,000 Samsung grant.
Oh, is that for like Solve for Tomorrow?
Exactly. I won the Solve for Tomorrow. Oh, cool. You know that?
I hosted a Solve for Tomorrow competition a few years ago. It was so fun.
Oh, it's great. Let me see that. That was,
the kids are incredible.
Yes, the kids are incredible. So you get some kids together and you locate a problem, a local problem in your community, and you figure out ways to work it out. That was about 4 years ago that we won that $150,000. But the reason I started moving more towards evolution education is I found that that's where my fellow teachers could use the most resources and the most help. Mm-hmm. And I also felt like it was a very, I'm optimistic about evolution education, and climate change can really get me down sometimes in my beautiful home here in South Florida. So, yeah. So I feel like I'm working on something that has a great future.
Absolutely. I would love to know, what are these workshops like? Like when a teacher signs up or says that they're interested, you know, they go to the Ties website. There are obviously a lot of resources available, lots of articles that are shared, videos, there are walkthroughs for the workshop, and there are all these great activities and, you know, resources that are listed. But let's say that a teacher decides that they want to take the workshop.
Right.
What does that involve?
We have workshops that are 60 minutes long. We have workshops that are a day long. So a 60-minute workshop is basically a presentation, a slide presentation on content that's based on, depending on what state we're in, that state's middle school evolution standards. And then we give them that presentation. Actually, you could download it right now from the website. But that presentation it's not meant to be used as a lecture, God forbid. It, you know, there's active learning ideas.
It'd be super boring for the students.
Yeah, so there's hands-on activities under every slide. There's links to very fun videos and stuff like that. That's a 60-minute presentation. You have the PowerPoint and you have maybe a quick tour of the website. If we have an hour and a half, 2 hours, then we will do a very fun lab, which the one we tend to do is called This Lab is for the Birds. which is based on the work of Peter and Rosemary Grant in the Galapagos, and how they saw speciation, actually, I believe they're seeing now, but seeing a change in the beak depth of the medium ground finches on Daphne Major because of drought years versus years with plentiful rainfall.
Is this the couple that like lives all alone on Daphne Major? Nobody's allowed to visit ever.
I don't know if that's the case. I'm sure they have like grad students working with them and stuff. I saw them a couple,
but I think
years ago.
They've been I there think Daphne Major years. You're not allowed to walk yeah. on. Yes. Okay. When I visited the Galapagos, our guide was like, "There's, you know, where that's Daphne Major. It's really cool. It's one of the places where you're not allowed to go visit, but there is a couple yeah. who are researchers who have like special dispensation to live there.
They're lovely.
Oh, it's so cool. Oh, that makes me so happy that you have curriculum developed around their
yes,
findings.
It's called, their names are Peter and Rosemary Grant. And what they found was the medium okay. ground finch has a beak depth of, say, whatever, X millimeters. But there was a terrible year in the 70s that rainfall was absolutely gone. The only food items left for the birds were very hard seeds. And the birds with the slightly smaller beaks died, all of them. And then it kind of drove the natural selection towards a greater beak depth. So what we do in the lab is I trust my kids. So I make them put the beaks. I'll tell you what the beaks are in a second in their mouths, but I take a big tablecloth. I put all the classroom chairs to get tables together and I throw a bunch of gummy bears all over the place. And then the bird, the phenotypes are spoon or fork. And so uh-huh. they have to pinch it with or scoop it. The gummy bears and put it into their little cups. I tell them I'm Mother Nature. I could kill them at any moment if they're trying to push another bird out of the way or steal food items from another bird. Although in nature that would happen. And at the end, depending on how many food items they collected, they either die, remain alive, or actually remain alive and reproduce. And after nice. A few rounds of this, I eliminate all the gummy bears and I throw M&Ms and Skittles on the table. So, you know, the knives are in big trouble. The knives are going to die. Yeah. The spoons do pretty well. The forks, not so much. And then they analyze their data and they show the change in the, you know, the allelic frequency, let's say, of the different beaks over time. And for ties, we've narrowed it down to a paper plate with four kids around it. And they're using their mm-hmm. hands instead of their mouths. Mm-hmm. And they have the fork, the spoon, the knife, and the toothpick. And they are measuring the same changes over time. And it's very important to stress to the teachers, this is within a species. Because, you know, teachers get that yeah. wrong. They think of the, you know, the spoonbill versus the egret versus the blue heron. No. These are variations within the species, the bird types, mm-hmm. the beak types. And that is a lab that a teacher can do for less than $5 because they do raisins and popcorn kernels. Mm-hmm. You know, I suggest get.
You want to be a little healthier.
Yeah. But that's the, so when you were asking me about the lab, the length of the workshops or what's going on, that's when you have 90 minutes to an hour. So you do the PowerPoint, you show them all the little resources on the PowerPoint, and then you do that lab. Now, if we have longer than that, it gets really fun because what I'll do is a station lab rotation where they're spending, you know, 15, 20 minutes at that lab. They're spending 15, 20 minutes at another natural selection lab and 15, 20 minutes on a game, an online game that the kids can play on the computer. And then if it's a day long, we will always have in the afternoon. Oh, I have a great story for you. We always have in the afternoon a biologist come in. A biologist who works with evolution.
Oh, cool.
So we've had someone who studies the poison of sea snails. And by studying the protein, the amino acid sequence of these proteins, they can figure out which sea snails are related and which sea snails should be tapped for poison because they're related. So they might have the same kind of poisons, which are being used for medicines. We've had fish, fossil paleontologists. We've had... Gosh, I'm drawing a blank, but we've had tons of those. So those day-long workshops are really fun. And one of them happened here locally at Florida International University. And as I told you, as the teachers came in, one of them said, yeah, I don't really believe this stuff. 13% of high school biology teachers openly espouse creationism. I don't know what.
And they can't help but show that to their students. For sure.
At middle school, I don't believe we have data. I might be wrong, and you could ask the National Center for Science Education. They have a lot of great data. But I don't know if we've ever asked middle school science teachers how many of them believe in evolution. But if 13% of high school biology teachers are promoting creationism, I assume the numbers are even higher at the middle school level.
Yeah, because you're at the high school level, or your level, you're teaching generally evolution already, and you're teaching it at a deeper level.
Exactly. So middle school, what you get a lot are people who they're really good teachers, or maybe they were excellent elementary school teachers that have moved into the middle school level. But in my science department, I think there's only two of us with actual science degrees.
Yeah. I guess you probably more have a degree in education than a degree in science.
So these people come in. This is a Florida International University workshop 2 years ago, April. And this teacher says, yeah, I don't really believe it. I tell my students they have to learn it to pass the test. The college professor who was there, Dr. Eric von Wetberg, he gives me this look, and I give him this look. So the morning session is mine, right? So I do my presentation and I do a fun little lab and a few rotations and online games and so forth. And in the afternoon, he comes on. And what he does is he studies the chickpea. And he explains that the chickpea provides 20% of the world's population with its primary source of protein. And due to climate change, the chickpea crop around the world is in grave danger because there's no variability within the species, you know, the crop itself, and it's highly susceptible to these changes in climate. So he goes back to southern Turkey, northern Iraq, and he's getting wild chickpeas, which literally grow out of the rock. That's how hardy they are. Mm-hmm. Brings them back to the lab, crosses them with the agricultural strains, and he's improving the chickpea crop around the world. This is evolution in action, right? Evolution actually making a difference in the lives of humans around the world. If I could just tell you that was my greatest moment as a TIDES presenter, when that same teacher who that morning walked in and said, I don't accept evolution, blah, blah, blah. She says, I get it now. I understand. Because to her, evolution was Darwin and the Beagle. Or I don't know what it was, but it was a very watered down, generalized version of what is evolution. When people start to see what it's actually about, and like I said, it's informing agriculture and conservation biology efforts and stuff like that, it falls into place for them.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that teacher, she's going back to her classroom and she's never going to teach it like that again. She's never going to say, oh, you don't have to believe this. I just have to teach it and you just have to learn it. She's going to go in and she's going to be enthusiastic. And I don't know, let's say she has 150 kids a year. Times that she works for another 10 years. That's an impact. Small, but it's an impact. Yeah. And that's what we're trying to do with TIDES, is give teachers the tools and the confidence, and in some cases, the actual knowledge to teach evolution effectively.
Gosh, it's so important what you guys are doing. And it's so great to hear. You know, sometimes I think we got caught up in the cynicism or the pessimism that, you know, there are still so many people who espouse these creationist views, that we still do run up against a lot of pushback when it comes to it. But it's so nice to hear stories like that, stories of accomplishment and progress. I think it helps us maintain that. And it must for you, especially because you're in the trenches, you're doing this every day, helps you keep going, doesn't it?
Sure. And I think a recent study showed that people who understand evolution are much more likely to accept evolution.
Oh, yeah. We covered that recently on SGU. Yeah. I remember that.
And I have to give I am one middle school science teacher in Miami-Dade County. So first of all, I really, really, really have to thank my lifelong idol, Richard Dawkins, for starting this program. Mm. I met him. I told him what I was doing in my school and in a couple neighboring schools. I told him I was providing my fellow teachers with some professional development in evolution education. And he said, wow, how can I help you? And he said, can I come to your school and speak with these teachers? I was blown away when he said that to me, because he's a busy guy, you know. And it turns out that conversation occurred. And he goes, look, in 2 weeks, I'll be back in Miami. I leave today. He said, I don't know where he was going. He says, I leave today. I'll be back in Miami in 2 weeks. I'm only there in the morning. I'm catching a plane home in the afternoon. If you could work it out, I know it's short notice, but if you can work it out in 2 weeks' time, I will be at your school helping you teach evolution to your handful of teachers at that point, right? Because that was just little, wow. little me in Miami. It was nothing back then. And he did. And Miami-Dade County Public Schools had the presence of mind to go, wow, this is huge. This is amazing. And they actually opened up the presentation to the whole school district. So there were actually hundreds of teachers there. And they were so excited to meet, you know, one of the most important evolutionary biologists alive. And that's when he said to me, will you do this for me nationally? And he had the faith in me, no pun intended, but he had the faith. We're talking about Richard Dawkins here, but he had the faith in me. He let me and Robin Blumner, who is the executive director of Now Center for Inquiry and Richard Dawkins Foundation, they said, go for it. They didn't put any restraints at me at all. They just said, do it your way. And I totally thank them for that, because it's like I said, it's grown so much, and it could not have happened without the Richard Dawkins Foundation behind me. And now, you know, the Center for Inquiry behind me, because they're the ones that have, you know, the ability to promote and advertise and create a website for me and pay for my trips elsewhere and things like that. So it's just been a synergistic endeavor. It really has.
And so I'm looking at the website right now, and as you just mentioned, TIES, the Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science, is part of the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason Correct. And Science, which is a division yeah. of the Center for Inquiry. Now, this is a non-profit, yes. you know, a 501c3 entity, which means, you know, it really does rely on the support of people who believe in its yes. mission. So how can people, you know, what kinds of things can people do? How can they be involved to help, you know, if this is a cause that they really want to take up, which I think I wouldn't be surprised if my listeners really feel that way. So you know, what can they do?
Well, we do have a donate link on the webpage. And the easiest way to find the webpage is I Google TIES Dawkins. And I'm very proud of this because, you know, he's famous. Richard is famous for his ties, his neckties, hand-painted by his wife. And it used to be the first yeah. hit. When you Googled TIES Dawkins, you got Richard with his ties. But now you Google TIES Dawkins and you get the Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science. So this is a proud great. Moment when that shifted. But so we do have a donate link on the webpage. We also have a shop link, which is on Teespring, called TIES Treasure Trove. It's kind of hard to say. Mm-hmm. And you can buy t-shirts. I'm wearing one right now in the event that this was not just a podcast, but a webcast.
Yeah, just in case.
We have mugs, we have totes and stickers and things like that. We also have we would accept big donations. There's a wonderful man right now in Pennsylvania who's given us thousands of dollars, which has allowed me to hire a staff member to help me. It's a big country. And mm-hmm. I've been able to hire somebody who handles the Facebook page and a few other duties. So we're looking for big donors as well. I have a dream of having a 3-day workshop where we give scholarships to teachers. They come to Miami and we do middle school curriculum, but then we also have guest speakers, some of these local biologists coming in. So that's another yeah. way to help. And then if you don't have the money to help, but you have the knowledge to help, I'm constantly looking for new presenters or people who have contacts in school districts that can connect me to the local school district science supervisors or curriculum specialists and see if we can get a workshop for those middle school science teachers in that particular school district.
Oh, good. So if people go again to the website, which you can Google it, or it's very easy to find because it looks like it's just, I just closed it. History. Here it is.
RichardDawkins.net/
Yeah, /TIES. Yeah. And it's spelled like TIES, TIES. So if you go there, yeah, I'm seeing there's a donate, there's a support with swag, which is the shop. But of course, there is a link to your name all over the page. There's a link to Bertha Vasquez to register. Email Bertha Vasquez if you're interested. Yep. Email, you know, if you want to volunteer. So click on that link if you are somebody who is an evolutionary biologist or a teacher with good evolution, good knowledge and skills of teaching evolution. Or I guess if you just want to donate your time.
Yes, absolutely. I have, for example, there's a terrific paleontologist in Alabama who's going to present for us at, hopefully, if our proposal is accepted, at the Alabama Science Teachers Association annual conference.
Very cool.
We love the idea. The best workshops are when you get the teacher and the biologist together.
Yeah, that makes a real impact. Well, gosh, Bertha, this was a fascinating chat. I am so glad that we were able to align our schedules, that we were able to talk about this super important initiative that you're involved in. And I have to thank you for, you know, working full time as a teacher and then turn around and dedicating basically every free moment you have to improving evolution education throughout our country.
Thank you. I enjoy what I do. And by the way, I told my kids I was speaking with you today, and they're like, "That's the lady on the Bill Nye Saves the World show."
That's awesome.
I was like, yeah, that's because I have showed them a few segments of that. So now that is my claim to fame at my school, is not that I do the Ties the Teacher Institute. My claim to fame is that I spoke on the phone with Cara Santa Maria show.
Funny. Oh my gosh, I love it. And I'm of course over here like, it's just a dream, and I'm so honored to be able to be chatting with you. So I just have to say one more time, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
Of course. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.